Welcome back to another installment of the Healthcare Dealmakers Conference for the Digital Experience in 2020. Today is our fireside chat. I'm Bobby Guy, the chair of the Healthcare Dealmakers Conference, and I'm coming to you today from Nashville, Tennessee. Our guests for the fireside chat are the two healthcare leaders who were slated to deliver our keynote at the Dealmakers Conference in May, if it had been in person, like every other year, when we're not dealing with an international zombie apocalypse. Since this is now a digital experience in the midst of this, continuing through the year, we decided the best way to highlight the exciting story we're gonna cover today would be to set it here as a fireside chat. I resisted the urge to wear a Jimmy Carter cardigan sweater and to have a fireside backdrop like the fireside chats of old. So let me introduce our guests. Judson Ivey is the CEO of Ensemble Health Partners, which he founded in 2014 after spending almost 15 years as a revenue cycle executive at a large hospital company. It's now valued at more than $2 billion, Ensemble is, and it's a market leader. Judson's belief in loving what you do, providing excellent service, and caring about your team are at the core of Ensemble Health Partners' philosophy, and I think that will come through today. John Starcher is the president and CEO of Bon Secours Mercy Health System. He oversees strategy and operations for the system's 50 hospitals and more than 1,000 sites of care across seven states and then five locations in Ireland. Really cool. John's willingness to challenge the status quo and to innovate dramatically changed the trajectory of the health system he runs and made it a highly successful outlier in a rapidly changing healthcare environment. My job today is easy because this is such a great story with a few surprising twists and turns. I often say that the best presentations are ones that involve highly controversial statements and war stories, and I think we'll get many of both. So, John, why don't we have you start? Take us to the beginning of the relationship with Ensemble.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Teeing up the our relationship with Ensemble started really, it was a personal relationship between Judson Ivey and myself. Judson and I knew each other back from our days at Health Management Associates, probably 2012, 2013 timeframe, where Judson ran the largest group revenue cycle function when I became the group president. And then ultimately, when I became the CEO of HMA, Judson ended up running all of revenue cycle for HMA. So we've known each other since 2012, but specifically as it relates to this transaction, when I came to Mercy Health in 2016 to become the president and CEO, there were a few significant issues standing on the toes of the ministry at that time. They had a failed experiment with the acquisition of a Kaiser Permanente physician practice and health plan, which literally was bleeding tens of millions of dollars. They were looking at $300 million. Plus in losses for 2015 and 16. They also had a joint venture relationship that wasn't going well, and ultimately some significant revenue cycle issues, having a failed experiment with outsourcing to Parallon and then bringing that function back in-house after it wasn't working smoothly. When I was interviewing for the position of CEO, I took a look at the financials as any incoming CEO would do, and the revenue cycle performance really stood out to me as being probably one of the worst that I had seen in my career. If you looked across the board at all of the key metrics that drive revenue cycle performance, so if you look at cash collections, they were running at about 97% and therefore probably had another $130 million in cash shortfall. If you look at their cost to collect, it was well over 7%. If you look at their DNFB days, they were probably 11 or 12. Point of service collections, 20 basis points. Now, across the board, anywhere and everywhere you looked, you could tell that there were some significant issues. So in the interview process with the Mercy Health Board, I asked permission, should I become the CEO, to pursue three strategies, and that were to get out of the Kaiser Permanente health plan and to fix the joint venture relationship and ultimately fix revenue cycle. The board was familiar with the preceding two issues, but they had no idea the tsunami that was about ready to hit with respect to revenue cycle, because the way our revenue lags in the industry, that performance hadn't flown through the estimator tools yet. And so the board couldn't appreciate the losses that were about to come to compound the other issues that were confronting the ministry. So I had to walk them through that as a bit of an education process. And ultimately, given the relationship that I had with Judson, very quickly talked about Ensemble coming in to fix the problems. I knew we didn't have time to fix them ourselves. I knew I didn't have the talent internally to do that. And I knew I couldn't turn around and outsource the relationship again, given what had just happened with Parallon. So I asked the board if I could acquire Ensemble. And while they were ready to allow me to proceed as the new CEO to fix the health plan issues and the joint venture relationship, they were reticent to do so in terms of the cash needed to acquire Ensemble. But ultimately, I was able to convince them of that. I was able to convince Judson that this could be a much stronger partnership, having Ensemble within the Mercy Health portfolio than acting independently. And we struck up a conversation and ultimately the relationship that led to the acquisition of Ensemble in 2016. So we have several years before us before that, but ultimately got to the point where convinced the board and convinced Judson that it would be the right thing to do for his company and for the ministry.
Judson, what's it feel like to run a revenue cycle management company and be approached by one of your clients, it's a nonprofit, saying, hey, we want to do an acquisition, we want to merge this?
Yeah, well, probably that's a good question. You know, I was doing what I loved and building a business and doing rev cycle. And, you know, when John first asked me, you know, my answer was really no. And really, if it had been anybody other than John, I would not have even further entertained it. And John asked me why the answer was no. And in my mind, I had spent my entire career working in large health systems and wanted to get away from that, right? Wanted to purely focus on revenue cycle and wanted to, you know, kind of make revenue cycle a value add, not just a cost center, it's been perceived. So we had other customers that approached us, and quite frankly, we weren't interested. But John is convincing, if not his best trait. And John, you know, said to me, look, why is it? And I laid out the reasons why. And John said, look, we will partner together to make sure your things that you're worried about don't happen. And those were things that were, you know, just around the ability to do what's right for a customer and not to focus on just BonSecure, the other ability to kind of make sure our team was focused on as a priority, not just as a call center of rev cycle. And so we laid out those reasons, and John said, absolutely, you know, I intend to let you run the business. And he has kept every bit of his word with that. And so it's made it not only a great deal, but certainly fun and exciting for me.
So it's a very sort of unconventional business move, especially from the nonprofit side. I'd love to hear some stories about what the deal-making process was like as you entered into this.
I'm sure we could fill volumes with that, but just, you know, a couple to get started. You know, you need to suspend your credulity, but large nonprofit systems, particularly faith-based systems, aren't known for their alacrity, aren't known for their innovation or their speed or willingness to take risks like this. And so once I got beyond convincing the board that this was the right thing to do, I really had to convince the internal team as well. And so, you know, I have a general counsel in place and a CFO in place that had gone through a really bad experience in the prior outsource opportunity, and convincing them to get on board and to move through this transaction swiftly at the speed and pace that I wanted to, and at the speed and pace that Judson needed for his team to limit disruption, it was a yeoman's task at the very least. And so we engaged in negotiations with Judson and his legal counsel, and we were very aptly represented by Polsonelli and Frank Caranda through the process, who did a brilliant job. But, you know, Michael Besney, our general counsel, that I think is one of the best in the business, having gone through the previous transaction and still had the battle wounds fresh from that, was pushing back constantly throughout at some of the unique requests that Judson had to make sure that he and his team could maintain their autonomy, their independence, separate pay and benefit plans, that they weren't just wrapped into this huge bureaucracy. And so I can recall several times throughout the transaction where, you know, he would push back as general counsels are supposed to do and say, we can't do that or we shouldn't do that. And there were a few times where he was pretty profound in his pushback and say, you know, there's not a chance I'm going to allow this provision in that contract to happen. We're just not going to do it. And, you know, Michael and I have known each other for probably the better part of 15 years. And I can remember only two disagreements. And that was one where at some point in time, I just had to remind him that appreciate your counsel, but I'm the CEO and I'm going to make this decision. We're going to take this risk. This is the right thing to do. I know Judson. I trust Judson. He's going to deliver on this. And in fact, you know, that's the rest is history. I just a postscript to the immediate acquisition. When I said all those issues that were wrong in terms of our metrics and performance, soon after the transaction, you know, our decision was borne out to be the absolute right thing to do because, you know, Ensemble in less than 6 months picked up that $130 million shortfall in cash collections. They increased our point of service collections by probably 300%. Our cost to collect came down 300 basis points. I can go across the board. DNFB days were cut in half. Just unbelievable delivery within 6 months post-close. And so all of those naysayers and all of those that pushed back felt a little sheepish in coming back to me and saying, okay, I think that was the right decision. But it's been just a brilliant relationship and a pleasure all the way around. I'm sure Judson's had many of the same stories on his side of the table in terms of the trepidation of moving forward with a large system. But I'll let Judson speak to that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the normal approach to an acquisition is we're buying you and you will fold in and kind of march in line. And we were everything except for that. And so my attorneys had kind of taken all our concerns and built an argument around all of that. No, we won't have your benefits. No, we won't do these things. And it started off in a very, I won't say contentious, but just a lot to accomplish and bridges to build. And I'll give you a couple of stories. Is you know, the first time I met Michael Besny, nicest guy you will ever meet, but he made it very clear to me he was having me checked out by the OIG and the FBI just to make sure I was a good guy. And so that was like meeting number one. I'm like, this guy clearly doesn't trust me at all. And so over a period of weeks and months as we negotiated, you know, Polsinelli did a great job. Our firm did a great job, but we came to some impasses. And one night it's about 9 o'clock and I'm still in their corporate office and kind of this little commuter office cubicle thing. And Michael Besny comes over and says, look, I know we're not supposed to talk to you without your counsel, but could we offer you to join us for dinner? And so there are a lot of great restaurants in Cincinnati. And so I anticipated that we'd be going out to dinner over a nice glass of wine. And he said, yeah, come on over. And so we walked over to his office. And him and Kathy Burns, his associate general counsel, had ordered takeout chicken dinner for two. And so they added a third plate and we split a chicken breast around the table. And I tell you that was, you know, it was probably a $9.99 meal, but it really is kind of the meal that brought us together. You know, we talked about, and the first time we kind of sat down and just got to know each other and talked about what was important to us and what was important to him. And that really changed the course of the deal, was a $9 chicken dinner. And I give Michael a lot of credit and Kathy a lot of credit for kind of putting their egos aside and saying, let's just try to understand what's important to you. And so that's probably the most memorable moment for me, is kind of the turning point of where after that, it seemed pretty easy to get the deal done.
You never underestimate the healing power of chicken, right? Well, let me ask, coming from that, the story starts with mercy, John. I know that at that point, tell us how the Bon-Secours merger fits into all of the story.
You know, the Bon-Secours merger with Mercy Health is just part and parcel of the phenomenal growth story of both Mercy Health and also Ensemble. So, you know, recall that in 2016, when Ensemble became a part of the Mercy Health family, I think at that time, Ensemble had 10 hospital or health system clients, and have since grown to over 36. And at the time, they had $1 billion in net patient revenue under management, and now have in excess of $19 billion. Or if you look back there, they had, I think, Judson, correct me if I'm wrong, but a couple hundred associates. And now you're well over 6,000, approaching 7,000 associates. And so the addition of Bon Secours, the merger between Bon Secours and Mercy Health, obviously created organic growth opportunities for Ensemble, and gave a larger platform for more success. Because just as Ensemble came in and fixed the issues that plagued Mercy, Ensemble was very swiftly able to plug and play in the Bon Secours environment and create standardization and consistency across the board and bring that same excellent performance to the legacy Bon Secours facilities. I think that's really when many other health systems began to take note and aggressively move towards Ensemble in an outsourced solution, many of which have since moved to full outsourced solutions. Just watching the success of Mercy Health and then Bon Secours and us coming together in Ensemble's role in that has created a great platform for growth for Judson and his company. And I think that's part of the story also that precipitated, you know, the decision ultimately to syndicate, which I know we're going to get to and happy to walk through that. But, you know, just in short, Bobby, to your question, part and parcel, the growth story, the phenomenal trajectory of this company and the great work that Judson and his team has done.
So that was 2016 when Ensemble came in. And then when did the Bon Secours merger happen?
In 2018, so about 2 years later. So okay. gave an opportunity for Judson and his team to fix all that ailed us within Mercy, and to be in a position to digest another huge acquisition, you know, over $4 billion in NPR at Bon Secours in and of itself. And that isn't to say that Judson and his team also didn't grow outside Mercy Health from 16 to 18. They did. Quite successful in picking up clients along the way. So you had both this internal explosion in growth as well as the external client base. And the fact that they've been able to scale so easily, frankly, and digest this tremendous growth over the past 4 years, I think is one of probably the most poignant cases that can be made for success for Judson and his team. Hmm.
Judson, any thoughts from you before we jump into sort of the syndication on it? Any thoughts about the growth and the Mercy Bon Secours merger and how all this fit for you?
Yeah, sure. So I think when we started our deal conversation with John knew that I did not want to just be a captive to Bon Secours Mercy Health, because I felt like we wanted to help other health systems that were in similar situations. And so John was respectful of that. Although his priority was to say, hey, you know, you gotta make sure you're doing everything you can for BSMH. And so I said, look, we are, but it's not gonna be an exclusive. And I would say that John's vision of taking struggling healthcare systems and allowing us to be part of that sphere, meaning revenue cycle, has been very, not only innovative, but effective in turning around other hospital systems. So I think our growth came from two things. One, BSMH growing, but then other providers seeing what John was doing and the good results of integrating a system such as Bon Secours into Mercy. In addition to, many people don't know this, but John's system went through 22 Epic go-lives during that same 18-month period. And if you've kind of kept up with the news, there's two places you can end up when you go do an EMR installation. You can end up on the front of Becker's saying you lost a bunch of money, or you can end up on, you know, in the good. And so for John to do an acquisition of Ensemble, 22 Epic installs and go lives, and an acquisition of Bon Secours, and without a hitch, really is a testament mm-hmm. to our growth came from that, but it came from people from the outside looking in and other hospital CEOs saying, you know, we want to do the same thing.
That's awesome. Well, let me take it to the sort of the more recent year then. So we come from 2018 with the merger with Mercy and Bon Secours to 2019. And I think the crowning achievement on a lot of this to date, right, we'll see what the future holds. There may be more. But the crowning achievement to date was the spinoff of a large chunk of the equity in Ensemble after dramatic growth. So tell us how you got to that point, and then let's talk through the deal making on that one.
Sure. So I think, you know, the growth that Ensemble was experiencing and that Mercy Health and then Bon Secours Mercy Health was experiencing in part informed the decision to seek a third party syndicate and a capital investor and someone that could give their full time and energy to continuing to foster the growth and the opportunity of this very unique platform. While it was at the time, you know, prior to 2018, prior to the syndication last year, a wholly owned subsidiary, we still had difficulties as a large nonprofit in operating it fundamentally as a completely different company. And so when you think about the pay and benefit structure and you think about all of the things that you can ordinarily standardize across your regular acute care and non-acute care platform, Ensemble didn't fit nicely into any of those boxes. And then if you also looked at the huge capital appetite that we have in the healthcare industry, based on just deferred maintenance and the things that we need to do to take care of 300 million plus square feet and 1400 facilities and 3000 doctors, we have competing capital interests. And Judson and I had some good heart-to-heart conversations prior to the decision to go out to syndication. I didn't want to see Ensemble be deprioritized with competing capital interest with the healthcare system proper. And so I thought syndication would be one way in which we could ensure there was a concerted, focused effort to infuse the appropriate capital, to infuse appropriate technology, to seek a partner that might bring some new competencies outside of the proper healthcare system to the table, and to ultimately continue to foster that independent streak that Judson and his team have by ensuring that Ensemble wasn't wrapped into this huge bureaucracy of a large nonprofit system, but had the ability to spread their wings and be independent in their decision-making with respect to their culture, their pay, their benefits, and quite frankly, everyone else they're competing with in the RCM space at the time were either private equity run RCMs or publicly traded RCMs, but certainly they were all in the for-profit space. And so I also recognize that that might create some handcuffs that for Judson and his team that wouldn't be suitable for a long-term relationship. And so that's how we came to the decision, at least from my perspective. I'll let Judson speak to it from his perspective and decide to go down the path of syndication and start the process with getting a banker to represent us, which was Guggenheim. And we went to market and we looked for interesting parties. And when you're looking at a company that we believe should have been valued well in excess of $1.5 billion, there aren't that many private equity companies that can come in and write that check. So we didn't know how many we would have expressing interest. But I have to tell you, and Guggenheim would confirm, as would Judson, we had more interest than we knew what to do with. We had initially over 20 private equity companies come forward expressing sincere interest and putting their money where their mouth was, and whittling that list down from 20 to 14 to 7 to ultimately 3 was a difficult challenge in and of itself, but certainly a nice problem to have with all that interest. And so that's really what led up to the decision. And the process itself was very thoughtful, very deliberate. I think it probably one of the best processes I've seen of its kind that resulted in the outcome that we all know that we have today. But I'll yield to Judson on how he viewed the decision to syndicate and the process itself.
Yeah, John, I think you captured most of it. I think for me, there was a desire to find a partner that had other assets or other capabilities and competencies that they could add to the business to make us stronger. But also, as John mentioned, there were 20 plus folks that were interested. So finding the right partner that understood that, at least as a founder, my relationship and our relationships of doing the right thing for customers, what was going to continue to have to be the priority, because that has always been how we founded our business. And so we weren't looking for someone to come in and slash cost and take out people. That was not what we were trying to do. And I think to John's credit, he structured the governance structure early on in the deal to ensure that we stayed a provider focused organization. And so immediately, you can take 20 and go down to 10 who seriously want to think about that around doing the right thing and a long-term thing for providers. And so the process was you know, interesting, but it was also, it was a long process. And even though we started off by calling it a narrow process, it didn't seem like it. But the benefit was that we ended up with a partner who valued service and quality and our relationship with providers as the kind of paramount governing factor of the deal. So I think we certainly chose the right partner, and the process produced the result that we expected.
So let me ask on that. You just started to allude to it. What made you pick your partner in this one? What were you mentioned a few of the guiding points. How, with 20 different suitors, how do you narrow it down to the right one to be in a business like this with for a long time going forward, right?
Yeah.
Either one, if I could answer for that, would be great.
Hi, John.
There were two different stages of narrowing it down, Bobby. And, you know, one was out of the gate, we were firm on the governance structure that would need to happen post-syndication vis-a-vis 50% representation of governance of Bon Secours Mercy Health on the new co-board. So, you know, that's a threshold that, quite frankly, many investors, when they're going to take a 51% ownership interest, won't even cross. And so many self-selected out after the fact that we didn't budge on that. And then with that 50-50 representation, we had pretty fixed negative controls that we wanted in place as well, not only so that we could accomplish equity accounting, but so that we could protect the culture that made Ensemble so successful. So, you know, hiring and firing the CEO, we wanted to make sure that Judson was going to continue to be the CEO, and we wanted a say in that. We wanted to be able to foster and nurture and continue to grow a culture that was unique to Ensemble and not have it destroyed by a third party that had their own thoughts and just focused on expense management. And so when you get to go through some of those cultural issues and the kind of the must-haves from our perspective, you begin to whittle that list down to kind of the vital few. What we didn't have any problems with throughout is a private equity firm that was willing to write the check. I mean, I literally probably at least 10 or more than 10 came forward with a bid that would have rang the bell. And price at the end was not the differentiator. I think it's been publicly reported, you know, we had a $1.8 billion valuation. Bon Secours Mercy Health was able to take in $1.2 billion in cash on the balance sheet for a $1.9 billion gain. You look at all of that versus the $60 million initial investment that we made in 2016 with a $50 million earnout that Judson and his team easily brought. Look, it turned out to be an exceptional deal, but again, price wasn't the differentiator. I think the other thing that Golden Gate Capital, who is our partner and very proud partner, we have had a tremendous relationship with them. Their fund was unique in that it's a perpetual fund. And so unlike many other private equity firms that have a 4 to 7 year horizon before they won a liquidity or monetization event, Golden Gate proved that they had the staying power and the willingness and ability to stick with acquired companies for the long haul and to make the necessary investments. They also had a fintech edge and background to them in the healthcare space. We knew that we needed some technology investments and not just the typical investments that health systems would make. They brought that to the table. And then from my perspective, most importantly, they had an appreciation and respect for Judson and his team and just admired the phenomenal job that they did and said, listen, we're not going to pretend to be revenue cycle experts or healthcare experts. We have a viewpoint and we'll advance that viewpoint, but we're not going to change the way you've done business and we'll continue to do business. The recipe for success is incredible. And why would we disrupt that? So when you look at those three factors in particular, that's certainly what led me there. But I think Judson and I pretty quickly aligned on it throughout the process.
It's interesting to me that in a market where we have so much money in private equity right now, right, that a differentiator for the private equity fund that you picked, and this may be an economic point for some of our listeners, was permanent committed capital, right, that it was not going to change. That was one of the things. The other thing I think that was important in the midst of it is it sounds like you married mission up with money, right? So it wasn't just all, it wasn't all about the money, which is often how many transactions can go, but based on the nonprofit background and the mission of the, of Bon Secours Mercy, you made both of those sort of integral to the deal. Is that fair?
100%. You know, at the end of the day, the reason why deals fail 90% of the time is because of cultural differences. And we spent most of our time making sure there was going to be alignment on the culture. And I think far too many folks that go through a syndication process like this, whether they're selling all of a company or part of a company, focus on the bottom line dollars. And while certainly important, isn't the most important thing. You have to make sure there's that alignment, particularly with respect to the culture and how you're going to run the company, because it's an unmitigated disaster if you don't. So we spent almost probably not, 90% of our time on this culture issues, if I had to guess.
And I would add there, I would add that, you look at the background of Golden Gate and they don't have extensive experience in healthcare compared to the number of private equity companies that almost specialize in healthcare. And so I think for me, the fact that they respected that they didn't want to become experts on how to run the business. Now, they are, I would say, now very educated and well-versed in how the business runs, but they don't want to run it. And two, their commitment to the understanding that, look, they weren't the experts. And then in order to have client successes and operational successes, they had to allow the experts to be that. And then today, even at the point of due diligence, I was impressed about how much they wanted to talk to customers versus, certainly dig into the financials, but the request to talk to customers and repeated requests to understand the impact we were making was meaningful to me, because you're always worried about the bait and switch of, okay, yeah, this is something we care about, but the minute we own it, it's going to change. And it hasn't. It was funny. We were in a meeting yesterday and there's, a deck of slides. And one of the things that they're intently interested in is customer satisfaction, feedback, and operational results around those customers. And I think that just solidifies what we set out in our search for a partner, was to say, look, you have to be aligned with the mission of what we do. And part of that is doing right by these customers.
So many of us who live in the transactional world are all thinking about the terms of the deal as we're getting it done. And I think the point is well taken about culture and how deals fail. Often the lawyers and the investment bankers and everyone aren't around for the integration piece of it, right? And so I think that's something that the audience absolutely ought to take away from this, is how much culture is part of this process. And it's a great point for the team to make. So what do you see next? Well, actually, let me ask before I go there. I'd love to know what the board thought of all of this process and going through it. John, do you want to answer that one? They obviously were a little stunned with the initial idea of acquiring a revenue cycle management company. How did they feel about the spinoff process and what that was like in the midst of running a nonprofit with a mission?
It's a fascinating process. And what I would say is that what was unique about it is, recall what I said before, that back in 2016, the Mercy Health Board had a really difficult time, writing a $60 million check for the initial acquisition. And one of the things that ultimately proved in their confidence with Ensemble is the fact that the earnout that I referred to, in order to get that, Ensemble had to bring $500 million to the bottom line of Mercy Health. And that was supposed to happen over 5 years. Well, Ensemble did that in less than 3 years, and probably closer to 2 years than 3 years, and achieved the earnout. What was unique about the situation is Mercy Health board members that went on the new board, Bon Secours Mercy Health, were familiar with the transaction and all that led up to it. The incoming Bon Secours board members that made up now the new Bon Secours Mercy Health board knew nothing about Ensemble, didn't have the history of that transaction. And so when I teed up with them this syndication process for this portfolio company, they didn't have the luxury of having that background or information, and it was completely foreign to them. So having to walk the entire board back through the process, where we started in 2016, where we were at in 2018, what the process for syndication would look like in 2019, was appropriately laborious, to say the least. But I think all of those new board members, their eyes just, they popped wide open. They couldn't believe that just 2 years prior, we had made this $100 million investment that had now turned into a company that was in excess of 1.5, probably closer to $2 billion. They were amazed and basically just sat back and said, "You obviously know what you're doing here. We're going to let you run this process. It makes sense to us." The Mercy Health Board members that had had that history, there were a couple of them that were probably the biggest opponents to doing it initially. And not that I take any pleasure in rubbing that in, but we have some good-natured fun and have had over the years about their initial resistance. And ironically, or not so ironically, but just a testament to their character, they'll be the first to admit that their hesitation up front was misplaced, and they are now Ensemble's biggest champions. In fact, one of them in the first couple of years of Ensemble actually became a board member for Ensemble. So wow. It's great to turn some of your biggest opponents into some of your strongest advocates, and that's the unique ability that Judson and his team have. And they won the full faith and confidence of our board. And the board, unlike many nonprofits, you know, supported this process all the way through, understood, appreciated it, understood its nexus to the ministry, understood the fact that we weren't going to sell out culture or who we are, that the way in which we ran revenue cycle from beginning to end, you know, remember all the forward-facing elements of revenue cycle. You're talking about registration and scheduling and verification and authorization, a lot of patient contact, and you know that that has to be done carefully, particularly in a nonprofit faith-based ministry. And they got Ensemble's competence in that. They've seen the success, and like I said, those original naysayers are the strongest supporters. The incoming Bon Secours board members have just embraced it completely. Have been fascinated by the process. My only problem now is they expect me to be able to have a deal like this every year or every other year. So they keep saying, "When's your next Ensemble, John? It's been a year. Come on, do something else."
Yeah, a good problem to have, right? I mean, I'll tell you that in the midst of such rapid change in healthcare, which COVID, I personally think, is accelerating, right? All of the trends that we were seeing before. What your story shows is that doing, I'm going to quote two truisms that we also know in business, continuing to do what you've always done is not going to allow you to sort of change and innovate to in a rapidly changing environment. And also, I think it sounds like your view was that what got you here was not going to get you there, right? There was a major change in adapting in this environment, which is changing so quickly. That this was a big jump, and I bet it's hard for board members, no matter how large the system, in a nonprofit context, especially, to say we're doing what, right, and then to do it over. So, a true tribute to the team and to the and to the board in being able to sort of get their arms around that and then make the jump.
Yeah, Bobby, maybe I'll just add to the board conversation because I think it's critically important, right? I mean, there's the deal and there's the growth of Ensemble and then the monetization of that. But none of that really could have happened unless we had aligned the Mercy board around what needed to happen to not only make Mercy successful, but ultimately Ensemble successful in this arena of a large Catholic faith-based organization. And part of that journey was with them, which I give them 100% of the credit, was their willingness to say and accept, here's where we are, here are the changes that have to be made in order to get us where we need to be. And there were two things really that were pivotal moments for me as I was presenting to the board. And keep in mind that I was probably the antithesis of the person they would have hired, because I had all for-profit healthcare as my background. And that's not usually consistent with the mission. But there were two turning points. One of the sisters on the board said to me, "We have to have money to have the mission, but we will always do what's right to take care of those that cannot afford to pay." And the second part was, I did a presentation about that was chock full of kind of criticisms of here's where we are and where we got to go. And at the end of the board meeting, she came up and gave me a hug. And Michael Besney came to me after the meeting and says, she hasn't hugged a presenter in 20 years. So you clearly have made an impact. And so, yes, the exciting part of the story is the growth of Ensemble and the sale to Golden Gate and all of that. But there was a lot of hard work behind the scenes by John getting the board to come along with a vision that at first blush is the antithesis of what they would want to do, right? I mean, who wants to hire a for-profit healthcare guy to turn around a not-for-profit mission? But John was able to do that. They get a lot of credit in following the vision and coming along and supporting the journey.
So let me ask, what do you guys see next for Vaughn Secours and for Ensemble?
Well, hopefully more of the same continued success and growth and you know, quite frankly, given their success and their performance and the way in which they've been able to turn clients around, I see nothing other than that. What I would say, and it's to your point, Bobby, about business is anything but normal these days, and we can't continue to do things the way that we always have. The incidence of COVID-19 has shined a bright light on the industry in a way that it never has before. And so we've always had margin pressures by declining reimbursements and all the regulatory issues and move from acute care volume to ambulatory volume. Those have always been issues, but to compound that with this, what we're predicting is going to be a fairly significant swing in payer mix, right? With the ever increasing unemployment rate and people moving off commercial insurance into self-pay or Medicaid in 2021, the permanent shift in volume, certainly out of the emergency rooms, which we've all experienced that I don't see coming back ever, the increase in virtual visits and taking those visits out of the ambulatory settings, you know, all of those things that have happened that I don't think are going to change moving forward. Just human behavior with respect to their cautiousness around going into clinics when they don't have to and being seen at the time and place and in a manner they want to, which could be virtual or certainly in a more convenient location than Americans have been used to receiving healthcare. All those things have added up to this tsunami that we're facing as we head into 2021. And having a partner like Ensemble has been a huge differentiator for us. We were able to tell through Ensemble very early on and predict the impact on our volumes in the short run and truly flex our staff, because since they're the front end and they do the scheduling and the registration and the verification authorization, they're able to give us insight into exactly how our business was changing and what we needed to do to flex to meet it. And they've also given us insight and looking forward into the future about how the business has changed, what might recover, what probably won't recover, and where we need to place our bets as an industry moving forward. Quite frankly, without Ensemble, we wouldn't have that sophistication. We wouldn't have that technology. We wouldn't have that information. They can look not only across our organization, but across all of the country with the 380 plus facilities that they serve. And they see these trends and they're able to relay that. Ensemble's always been about helping the client, helping the provider be better positioned for the future. So, you know, I think that's what I see as a huge differentiator moving forward. Business will not be the same as we've not come to know it over the years in this space. It's not getting any easier. The pressures are inordinate. Not having a partner like Ensemble, I just can't imagine it. And I think more and more health systems are going to have to run to expertise in this space. They don't have the time, money, or human resources to invest in it themselves. And when you have someone that really pays attention to their customers like Ensemble, I think they can comfortably do so.
Judson, any thoughts on that? Looking forward to what it looks like next for Vaughn Secours and Ensemble.
Yeah, I mean, John's perspective is you know, John is in the weeds and understands exactly what's happening with healthcare system probably better than anybody I know. But our perspective at Ensemble is very similar, is that, you know, what we learned from John and his leadership team perspective is that, you know, revenue cycle of what we do is not very sexy, right? It is around kind of the front end, middle, and billing piece of the process. But what it does do is provide a lot of insights and learnings around the business. And so what we're continuing to focus on is how do you create value adds for customers, not becoming a commodity of simply billing and collections, but helping them provide insights into their business, helping them prevent and in the case of COVID, recover from these types of these issues. And then in our case, we're really intensely focused on how do you make providers help see revenue cycle as value creation, not as a call center. And that means different things to different folks, quite frankly. You know, the consumer is becoming our second largest payer, if you will. There's an immense amount of pressure on providers from not only regulatory, but payer pressures. And so we continue to see our future as helping providers navigate this, and it's becoming more complex every day, not less.
So, audience question for you. One is, can you talk about what the Ensemble team did at BonSecours to help improve the revenue cycle management? What was different than the previous processes? And I think you could answer that and then probably do a little bit of projecting into the future on that for where we are right now, right? What are the lessons for RCM in the current cycle and for predicting the future?
Yeah. So as a company, and BonSecours is not that much different than any other provider, but we have a philosophy that it really is, it's not about a bunch of people coming to work every day that say, I want to do a bad job. Healthcare is extremely complex, and typically poor revenue cycle functions is a result of bad people, process, and technology, but people usually being the smaller margin. And so we really believe that the results in revenue cycle are primarily driven around bad processes. And so what did we do at BonSecours and Mercy? We focused really on the processes and people understanding why, why we need to do it this way. And at every intersection we had, you're trying to teach clinicians, physicians, nurses, all the people that are involved in the process, why it's important for what the organization's goals, right? It's not just about billing and collecting better. It's about making a better patient experience. And if we can draw the parallels for them, which we did, to every area around, this is why your charges have to be captured timely. This is why they have to be accurate. This is why we code medical records timely. And so we re-engineered the entire processes front, middle, and back, but with the purpose of focusing on here's the reason why, and this is the impact. So two things there. One, it started at the top. We would not have been successful without John and his outstanding leadership team setting the tone to say, here's why revenue cycle is important to the organization, and here's how we're going to support them and how they're supporting us. That was the first thing that happened. And then two, the results were very visible and they were shared across the organization. And so I could get into the weeds about what systems we fixed and what, you know, how it all worked. But the two big things we did were align the importance of why revenue cycle was important across the organization, and then share at every level of the organization how what they were doing to help revenue cycle was improving the overall financial results of the ministry. And so, you know, but there's a lot in between there around systems and processes, but you know, those are just the nuts and the bolts.
So one more audience question. This one's potentially highly technical. So Judson, you can take a shot at this, but we're coming to the end of our time. So I'll give you about a minute if you want to take a shot at it. It was, how does Ensemble interject the DRGV and the CDI in the revenue cycle process to maximize the reimbursement for clients?
I'm going to let John answer that. I'm just kidding.
I was looking forward to that. Yeah, John. My last question is going to be: tell us about your outlook on the healthcare. Some predictions about the healthcare market for the short term and the longer term. So, Judson, I'm going to come back to you so you can answer the revenue cycle management, and then we'll go to one that John actually can answer.
Okay. I was just he probably can. So the short answer to the question is this, is that CDI, clinical documentation improvement, is probably one of the most important processes to ensure that you're aligning the services you're performing with the services you're documenting and ultimately how you're coding and getting paid for it. So we believe that CDI, there should be presence of two components, one, nursing side by side on at the bedside with other nurses, making sure the documentation is matched by physicians. The second process around DRG is that we learned a long time ago that the traditional method of kind of auditing to make sure we were coding correctly in your, you know, random sampling 5% of the accounts wasn't effective. And so we created technology that looks at every single coded account to ensure using algorithms and analytics and machine learning that the coding is correct. And if it's not correct, we feed that to a feedback loop that trends it by physician, by coder, by CDI specialist, and we then learn from it to ensure that we're educating physicians and clinicians on how to code and document. So that's the technical answer.
Got it. All right, so I'm gonna give, Don, let me just come back to you for a 30-second closeout. We're right at the end of our time, and then I'll exit us out. But the as innovators in healthcare, I'd love your personal perspective on short-term and medium-term predictions for healthcare. Any thoughts on that specifically?
Well, a bunch. You know, I think you have to have a foot on the boat and a foot on the dock, if you will, and you have to run the business and stick to the nuts and bolts and the blocking and tackling and do what you need to do to be successful in the short run. That hasn't changed. It never has changed. Never will change. But what is changing, as I said before, is the payer mix, the reimbursement rates, legislation, regulation. If you look at specifically transparency and surprise billing legislation, without regard to what administration is in the White House after November, I don't think those issues go away. And so you take all of that complexity, the regulation and the change in process and the change in mix, and what I would say is, again, as I said before, I can't see operating in that environment with someone without someone like Judson and his team in Ensemble, because how do we get our arms around transparency and truly move from this fee-for-service environment that we've been operating in for years and will continue to operate in the foreseeable future, but that becomes less and less prevalent. And as the demands of our consumer, particularly large groups, want to know exactly what they're going to pay, how they're going to pay it, and do that at the point of service instead of having it reconciled after the fact. And so if I had to look to the near or long term, I think those systems that are going to be most successful are the ones that solve that equation. Even if regulation doesn't require it, how are you going to make healthcare easier? And how are you going to make healthcare more accessible? And how are you going to bring down the health of the cost of healthcare so that it's sustainable? Because right now in its present form, it is not.
Thanks very much to both of you for being here with us and for agreeing to do first our keynote at the at what was going to be the live event and now the fireside chat. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you having us.
Thank you.
Meg, if you can jump over to the conference sponsors slide, I will make our way out. So for our audience, a note about upcoming events for the HDC digital experience. The 10-Minute Health BizCast is well into album two with a new track released today about the modernization of healthcare communications with Armand Serebrakian with Statum Systems. Next week, we'll release a two-part interview explaining current trends on the COVID testing side, that going through the confusion and working that out. That's with Carissa Jones of Mercodia and Dr. John Pignelli from the University of Pittsburgh. Our HDC market update webinar, the next one will be on healthcare finance, more specifically covenant compliance in a COVID world. And that will be led by Jessica Zeiger on October 22nd for a half an hour at noon central. Finally, in addition to thanking our guests and our sponsors for the digital experience through the year on the HDC, I want to thank the production team that's helped make this happen, including Meg Victor, who's our events coordinator. This year, she's become the czar of the webinar. I would say czarina, but it doesn't rhyme. John Henderson, our chair emeritus of the Dealmakers Conference, and Frank Caranda, a colleague who helped arrange the Bon Secours and Ensemble teams for today, as well as many more who deserve recognition, but unfortunately time does not permit. To all our attendees, thanks for joining us. Go forth and innovate. We look forward to seeing you again at the next HDC Digital Experience. Thanks very much.